Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 57 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of novelist and classicist Elizabeth Speller's interview with George Miller. Here, Elizabeth speaks with George about making the transition from writing non-fiction to becoming a historical novelist. You can hear the first part of the interview in episode 53.
My name is George Miller, and this is a concluding part of my interview with award-winning poet, classicist and novelist Elizabeth Speller. In the first part of the interview, we focus mainly on Elizabeth's four non-fiction books. Now it's the turn of her fiction. Her three most recent works have been novels, all of them set either during the First World War or in the interwar period. So far, two volumes in a projected trilogy featuring the adventures of former infantry officer Lawrence Bartram in the post-war world have been published, The Return of Captain John Emmett and The Strange Fate of Kitty Easton. The Independent called the former The New Birdsong, Only Better, and the BBC History magazine described the latter as an absorbing mystery story with a depth of characterisation and psychological acuity that is rare in crime fiction. And last autumn, Elizabeth published a freestanding novel, At Break of Day, set during the Battle of the Somme, which traces the fates of four very different young men. Kate Saunders wrote in The Times, "Elizabeth Speller has a wonderful feel for the era, and she weaves the stories of these young men into a heart-rending story of shattered hopes and dreams, switching viewpoints with effortless craftsmanship." I began this part of our interview by asking Elizabeth if moving to fiction was something she had foreseen from some way off.
I went for a viva at the end of my MPhil, and one of the professors who I'd been taught by and liked a lot, he was a kind of sort of mischievous but very clever man, said to me, "Well, this work," he said, "it has the most wonderful," I said, "it's full of elliptical aphorisms." And I remember thinking, "Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, what a find." And then slowly I thought, I'm not quite sure that's a compliment. And as we went on, he said, "It strikes me you very much prefer to think about your turn of phrase or the imaginative background to this than actually getting the facts and securing them." And although I did go into the laboratories and cry after my viva, what he said to me was a favour, really. I like making things up better. I was much more concerned with how things felt than footnote 52. And later on, he did say to a friend of mine, "I don't know why, she's perfectly clever enough, but it's not her natural milieu, academic work." And he was right.
So all the non-fiction had kind of been travelling in that direction already, hadn't it?
It had been travelling. I mean, I always wanted... I would have justified it by saying that in the ancient world, if you wrote history... I mean, history isn't an absolute. We write history in a sort of a way that has a sort of a scientific model, a sort of... A Germanic scientific model from the 19th century. In the ancient world, history was supposed to be plausible, it was rhetorical, so you merely had to be convincing, as if you were in court. I'm defending my view of history, and here's some nice facts that I'll throw in to make it feel comfortable. So I thought, well, I'm writing that sort of history, a plausible history, but actually on the whole, people in universities prefer the more recent model, where you have a great many footnotes and have read some books and looked at the original documents rather than looking up. I would do things like look up the weather. I'm very keen on looking up the weather on a certain day, because with the internet you can do this. And it makes a difference to me. It's a hot day, everyone's cross, or it's rather chilly for March. They're not really very interested in that, but in a novel you are.
Was it clear from the start that you were going to write historical novels?
For me, there's a huge problem now because of modern communications. The very first novel I wrote was sort of trial novel. I wrote with my closest friend at Cambridge, and we wrote a novel together, alternate chapters, and it worked extraordinarily well. We kept each other to it, you'd think it would be a disaster. We had quite different styles. It meshed beautifully, and it made really real nice, mice sort of whodunit, really, a sort of slightly intellectual whodunit. We had great fun with it. By the time, from when we started it to when we finished it, email and things had come in. When I went to Cambridge, a few Americans had this thing called email, where we didn't know what it was, and our essays were still handwritten. By the time I left, we were all on email, there were no pigeonholes, and we were processing our essays. So our book, which was supposed to be modern, depended entirely on pigeonholes and things like that, and it was impossible. And I think the immediacy of communication now spoils many things I'd like to do in a novel, dramatic pace. Whereas in history, I knew a lot. My first novel sort of set in the 1920s. It was a period I knew a lot about. I taught while I was doing my PhD, and I taught poetry of the Great War. I'd also, my own memoir had so many papers and things about the war and its aftermath that it was sort of, I had so much material. It was just an obvious place to go. I would like to try something modern, but it couldn't be straightforward because of all this. I just text, you know, you can't have any dramatic pauses or people waiting or messages gone astray. You know, you can't slip a message under the door like in Thomas Hardy, or can't send your priest a plague and strewn thing like in Romeo and Juliet. It's difficult.
So tell me then about the experience of writing that, the first published novel, The Return of Captain John Emmett. Was it duck to water kind of thing?
Most of my books are normally written when I'm contracted to write another book, which always seems to be a productive phrase for me. And I think I was contracted to write the book about Rome, and I had taken this amazing flat in Rome by the Tiber. In many ways, some of the skills are much the same as writing, for me, as writing non-fiction or travel or a memoir. But clearly in those cases, you have a structure because you more or less know where Hadrian's going. You do know where Athens and Rome are. And in a memoir, particularly mine, where I had a lot of papers, you have a skeleton you're going to write around. And that's half the challenge, sort of the two rubbing up together. In fiction, there's nothing. In my case, you know, I did have a bit about the Great War, so that's a bit of an absolute. So you haven't got that central core sort of to hold on to. And that was quite a problem when I was all over the place to start with.
And I suppose in non-fiction, you have a finite amount of data. You have what history provides you with.
Yes.
And you can extend a bit beyond that, and you can think about the structure, but there is a finite amount of historical data about Hadrian, say.
And also, you know, you go, like I say, you go to a spot and you think, this happened here. Or if you're going to stand by the bus stop in the Largo Argentina, this is where Caesar was stabbed. If you're making it all up, you can still find those places, but you'll have to think what your person did, because he isn't a reality. It is an event which will have happened somewhere, or you might already know a certain landscape you find interesting and you'll place them in it. So it was surprisingly different in that sense, but I don't think there's any difference between a sense of place, a sense of history, a sense of time, and a sense of the imagined world that you're creating. I think they use the same skills, really.
But do you have a heady sense of possibility that you can create any character in any situation and manipulate it as you will?
Yes, I do. I'm not somebody, I mean, when I talk to other authors of fiction, they seem to divide between those who think fairly carefully about their characters and have a pretty good idea how the whole book's going to go. They might deviate, but they have a sort of trajectory. And those who really have none, who set out on a journey with their characters. And a couple I've recently talked to who do much what I do, which is a fairly good idea where they'll end and the beginning, but they're not quite sure how they're going to get there. And I think I'm in that space. But the idea of sort of filing cards with each of my characters and their sort of trajectory through it, I can't imagine writing like that.
Or the modern equivalent, which is software, which does it all. It's all in virtual index cards.
Yes, and for people who love it. And always trying to persuade you to just get the bit of software that actually will write the novel while you do something completely different. But actually, I think in most of it's just sort of other diversions. You know, I might arrange all my books in colour or put all my penguins together on the shelves. They'll get another bit of software. In the end, you still got to sit down and write it.
And some novelists say at a certain point the characters took over, or at a certain point the book began to write itself. Is that something you can identify with? Is that something you've ever felt?
I do feel that, and yet when you hear people say it, I cringe a bit, you know, as if your character is so important. But it does happen. I suppose that is your unconscious. It seems to happen when you want A and B to have a relationship. It might be hate, it might be love, it might be vengeance, and it won't work because the chemistry is all wrong, or they just do things. It does feel as if they're autonomous, and yet it seems terribly pretentious to say so when clearly this is all a fiction. There's one time I came in when one of my characters had a fairly, came to a rather sort of tragic end. I found myself close to tears while I was making, and you think, no, I just made this up. I made up this character. I decided to kill him off. It was this rather elaborate sort of baroque death. And now I'm upset by it. But then a psychoanalysis say probably I've drawn on things within myself to do it. And now they've, you know, surfaced that I'm uncomfortable. But, yes, they do have their own And some of them are very frustrating. You know, I have one enormously frustrating character, and I seem to have him in all my books. So they're not biddable. And then occasionally you have ones you put in because you think you really ought to have one, and you know they're a bit wooden. Trying to make them live is actually quite hard.
Tell me a bit more about that. When you're revising, when you feel something isn't quite working, do you have a moment of insight where you see a way to make it work, or is it a long process of trial and error to get something?
In the days when you're sort of you're euphoric and it's just whizzing along, and you then do your calculation and know that you'll have finished this book in 3 months because you know you're on such a high, and then the next week you can't write a word. I think it's hard keeping characters in balance. So that you may have a minor character you quite enjoy, and you suddenly find they're so strong that that's the tune that people can hear. And I had a couple of characters in my very first novel, and I got a lot of feedback, particularly from the States, saying how absolutely fantastic these two characters were. By then I'd written my second novel, in which I hadn't got either of them or anyone liked them.
And it was too late to go back and put them in.
It was too late to go back and put them in. And one of them in particular, because the first novel, my novels are quite somber. With a light relief, and people say, I can't wait to see this again. I think when you're not going to, and then you feel slightly coerced that they should put in another appearance.
Did you feel you learnt a lot by writing that first published novel?
I did learn. I learned a lot. I probably learnt as much from my agent and editors. I mean, I sent it to my agent, and she told me that, quite frankly, it was nothing agents of non-fiction writers dreaded more than to get emails from their writers saying, oh, but I've now written a novel, and her heart really sunk. Then she said, actually, when she saw mine, she thought, no, she clearly is a fiction writer, but that I didn't really seem to understand how chapters worked, and it wasn't enough just to write so much and then have a stop because I sort of run out there. And so there were things I learned, and then when the editors took it, they took it subject to me reworking it. So I think the idea and the characterization was there and was quite strong, but probably structurally I still needed some advice about how to to pace things. And then you get more just feedback from people with the internet. So many readers write to you that actually if they all hit on a similar problem or question or thing they really love, you have to think, well, I need to consider that for my next book.
And has it changed you as a reader, becoming a novelist? Do you read fiction differently? With a more sort of technically appraising eye?
It's usually when I'm reading a novel, I think, ha, I got around that problem. I can see where they've had a problem and they've negotiated it beautifully. And sometimes the other way around, and you think you've made a mistake. I read a novel by a very, very eminent author recently, and I enjoyed the novel very much. I enjoyed it, one of the best novels that he'd written for me. But there was a lot of information dumping in it. And I thought, gosh, amazing. This level, his editor hasn't said, just spread this out a bit. We don't need a lecture. And then I subsequently met him and he said, oh, I absolutely wouldn't use an editor. I'd have a proofreader. And I thought, you needed an editor. It was very obvious. And there was another one I read again recently by an author who's many books to his credit, but he's getting older, and the book felt slightly out of touch. And again, I would be almost certain that his editors were too intimidated to tell him that some of the things needed to be shaped to make the periods that feel plausible. But there are novels you read and you learn from. You
actually consciously think, that was well handled. I must see if I can replicate that effect.
You sometimes structurally, or sometimes people pushing the whole idea of the novel a bit. And there were certainly novels I read when I was younger that were very different to other novels I'd read that made me think, gosh, so you could do this, in much the way that I might have read a history book or sometime and thinking, oh, so you don't have to start in 1880 and write, yearly. You could do it this way. So certainly there are novels you write and you think, well, I couldn't write like this. This is a fantastic book. I think probably Bring Out the Bodies was a bit like that for me. I'd read Wolf Hall and I quite liked it, probably not as much as other people. And then I read Bring Out the Bodies and thought, here she is. She's taking something. Everybody knows the story. And yet it's new and immediate and, terrific achievement.
You mentioned the information dumping danger. How do you personally make a judgment about how much of a historical period detail to evoke so that it for the reader it comes alive and has colour, but you stop short of demonstrating how much you know for the sake of it.
I mean, that's a great challenge of the historical novel, isn't it? When it's overdone, it's cringy. I'm sure it's why people don't write much after Daphne du Maurier. They don't write much about the Civil War and things, because sort of semi foot in sort of lace cuffs and you've got a few roundheads and a few cavaliers and tossing their curls. It's very hard to introduce material without it being either so whimsical or a lecture. My own feeling is you do it on the minutiae and not on the big things. So, you know, you'd have somebody coming in and the man would have to have somebody's hat. And you're not going to say, well, men in this period always wore a hat. Or the woman's rushing to go out and she can't find her gloves. We'll tell you quite a lot about, you did that. Me, it would be coming home and the water was cold because my heating system's a bit archaic. But each period has things. When I was little, the smell of the smog, that would set a book in the late 50s, early 60s quite nicely. But it isn't really who's in government or unless you're actually writing about that. So I think you create it very subtly. And you certainly don't tell people straight from a history book. You could probably do that as an end note if you really want to set something.
And what about the language that people use in speech and being aware of turns of phrase or slang or indeed things which weren't said at a particular time? How much of an effort is it to get that right?
I actually think that's the hardest thing, because I think what you're creating is something that feels like that period for somebody reading it now. And if you were to use a lot of the language they used, for instance, in the 20s, it would sound faintly comical and it would draw too much attention to itself. It would stand out. And the whole thing is that speech doesn't stand out. So you have to think of very subtle ways to indicate perhaps somebody's social standing, their intelligence, their occupation. You might not be using the words that are absolutely accurate, but you're using words that feel right. I mean, I have had people email me saying, well, they didn't use this expression until 1940. So people, these days, people will check. But I think if you were absolutely accurate, you couldn't write. You know, it would sound quite sort of...
It would sound like pastiche, wouldn't it? You'd be spending so much time making sure it was historically accurate that it wouldn't live, would it?
Yeah, I mean, if you say, I say you chaps, it's spoofy. Even if you think of how people spoke in the 60s, you know, saying fab or gear just sounds very awkward. So how far you take that is another bit. I think you get a better, when I'm writing in the 20s, you get a better thing from diaries where people are using slightly sort of more relaxed language. But and a lot of things they said would be slightly offensive now. So it's just getting that balance right. On the other hand, I don't particularly want to write in completely modern language. I mean, the way soldiers speak to each other now would be very different to how and soldiers to officers. But if you get it wrong, I read a book recently and the private is being addressed by a captain comes in and he sees one of his privates and he says, "Here, soldier," and that's what an American officer says to his British officer. Didn't call their soldiers, he would have said, "Here, private," or even Harris. And that for me, I lost that, the plausibility, the whole sort of great arc of it collapsed simply because he'd used an American phrase. So it's easy to get wrong, very easy.
And it's the kind of thing that once the reader's mind snags on it, it's difficult.
It's very hard.
It kind of makes the construction shaky, if not fall down.
Yeah, and that has happened to me, but perhaps particularly in areas where I'm writing myself, so I think I know what I'm talking about. And equally, I was called out my first novel I sent to Richard Holmes, the military historian now dead, Richard Holmes, and he went through it and sent me a daunting page of what seemed like complaints, but actually he was very positive about certain things. But he said, "You can't just have guns." He said, "What guns do you mean?" And of course, I'd have flung these people had guns. My hero, one crucial point, dropped his gun running across open ground, and he said, "It isn't a gun, he'd have a rifle. And it's on a lanyard," precisely so that he can't do this. And he said, anyway, soldiers, when they say guns, mean big guns. And these were tiny things that probably many other people wouldn't have noticed, but it's quite important to get right. And things on clothing. I don't have a great deal of sex in my books, but you have to sort of know if somebody was sort of faintly unwrapping someone, what they're going to come across in the way of underwear or where the buttons are or where the clips are. So it's not just language, it's a whole vocabulary of culture.
Are you also conscious of writing for an international audience? Because your books are published in the United States and throughout the English-speaking world, and they're being translated. Is that something that you have to bear in mind, or is that something which an editor points out later, that something perhaps doesn't speak to an American reader as immediately as it would to a British one?
I mean, I think your first book, you don't know that's going to happen. No, I'm slightly more conscious than Americans, certainly because they're quite a big market. I don't think you write for them, because in my case, I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect they're buying for Britishness. The subject is about the British experience, particularly the First World War. That's a very intense experience for us. It's a very intense but very different experience for the French. And I haven't sold to Germany, although, I mean, there's no hostile attitude, but it hasn't sold in Germany. But I think... But the Americans didn't come into the war in 1917, and they certainly didn't have the sort of traumatic shock, community, social shock, which they probably did have after Vietnam, but they don't, in the Second World War, they didn't after the First World War. So it's quite a small history. And I think that's what you're selling. Interestingly, my first book didn't sell in Scandinavian countries, and one of them said they liked the writing, they liked the characters, but they had no tradition of war in that period. What they liked was country house mysteries, and they were sort of golden age of detective fiction, and that's what they saw that period, how it represented itself in literature. My second one, which had a country house in it, they bought. And then other countries, one of the places I get the most feedback from, particularly on the first book, which is quite dark and about death and military justice, I get a lot of feedback from Israel. They say, because they're still got national service, there's still issues, their men still fight and some of them still die. And a lot of Israelis write to me. So it's interesting seeing where the feedback comes from and what people take from novels. A lot of feedback from the United States. A lot of people sort of see it as anti-war, polemic. People see it as what they want to see, really.
Now, having embarked on this sequence of novels, which has... the Great War in the rear view mirror, as it were, still its reverberations are still clearly being felt. You've interrupted that sequence to write At Break of Day, which is going to be published this autumn. Tell me what motivated that.
I think it was a consciousness that the centenary was coming up, and that the last members of the generation who fought that war, the last, were dying and have all died now. But of course, their children are still alive. And I mean, I don't see myself as writing an endless sequence of books about one person. I saw the books about Lawrence Bartram, who is in my first book, The Return of Captain Emmett, as being a sort of one story, which perhaps is a trilogy, taking a man from through a war, through the recovery, if such thing's possible, after the war, and until him finding the feet and going forward into the future. This book was really going to before the war, because the more I wrote, and I thought, well, gosh, you know, in 1912, many of the international tensions and others were there, but most people were just going about their jobs, thinking they would do what they were doing, probably the same thing as their father had been doing. How did it feel as they, first of all, began to realise that a war was coming, and the quite late realisation that it was going to come and get them? Because I think for a long time, most British men and communities thought, well, the army would go and fight this war. When it starts to realise that it's going to be come find you in your village or your shipbuilding enterprise or your country estate, that psychologically seemed very interesting to me. And one of the leading characters, I have four characters in this book, so it's sort of showing how different men make different decisions and then arrive on the same day on the Western Front. But one of them slightly cropped up with my memoir and had slight basis on my grandfather, who was happily established in America, working in the infant advertising business very successfully and having a glamorous life in America, reinventing himself as American. My hero hasn't changed nationality. People didn't on the whole. But he thinks of himself American. He has an American wife. And then he gets his papers. Do you go? You can probably not go. You can probably, as long as you go back to Britain or wait till it's all over. What are you? Are you British? Do you have any responsibility to the place you came from? And so some of that is his journey to whether he's going to return to fight in an increasingly unpleasant war. The others are characters, and one of the characters is a French, young French boy, 15-year-old, who lives on the Somme, because I think people would probably forget that.
It's a place,
and it was full of villages and towns, and a lot of people who lived on the river. What happens when an entire war comes to you and your family? So it sort of just interested me to see how people got slowly got sucked in. And the shop assistant, who has lots of plans, but they certainly don't involve fighting, and is saving up and buying bicycles and trying to get himself a wife. And the slow, very slow realization that it's going to, maybe going to mean him.
You mentioned there are four main characters. Did you set yourself a narrative challenge? I mean, as each new novel begins, do you sort of think, well, this time I'm going to see what I can... Are you sort of upping the ante each time?
Up the ante a bit. I mean, you want to do more... what I would see as more interesting things. But there were two things I was interested to write about: the British hospitals, famously a Scottish hospital, which was set up entirely by women. Doctors, nurses, staff, cooked. Every single person was a woman. They fully equipped themselves, got the money, raised the hospital, and the British establishment wouldn't touch them. And they were equipped to be a military hospital. And eventually the French took them and used them as a French military hospital. And I wanted to write about them because it's such a fantastic story of these doughty women, because they've been in medical school for ages and there were a lot of Scottish doctors. And the shock to the soldiers who woke up and found themselves surrounded by women. But I also wanted to write one of my lead characters that has synesthesia, where you hear music in colour. I read a little about it, then I heard a programme, Michael Barclay's Private Passions, and he was actually interviewing somebody I knew from Cambridge who'd been a friend, who was a doctor who had once been in a rock band. And she was very interested, and she was talking about music and these crossing of the senses and the much more modern understanding of how that works. And I suddenly thought, what would happen if you had a musician? In my novel, he's an organist who has to go to the front when he hears noise and music as colour. Would that make the experience somehow better? Would it make it utterly appalling? And my man has that, and he also has a thing of feeling occasionally other people's pain, which I'd imagine was a sort of a fairly neurotic expectation that if you broke your arm, I could feel it. But then recent scans have shown that in some people, it appears that electrical signals can be picked up. So there's this man who is really obviously unsuitable for any kind of service, who's a musician who finds himself nevertheless as a gunner officer on the first day of the Somme. He was slightly based on Ivor Gurney, although Gurney wasn't an officer. And at the same time, I was very interested in the sort of auditory landscape of that period, before you've got recorded music, before you've really got radio, you haven't got television, but you've got more street noise, street music. What would it sound like in Britain, and what would it sound like, the noise of war, and the music of war and the songs of war marching? So I was writing a great deal about that, a great deal about noise in the first part of the 20th century, I suppose, with this one man who can make noise that is very beautiful, or with his guns, noise that's quite appalling, and how does he survive through this? So that was probably my major challenge, because actually trying to write about two things, you can't hear the music and you can't see the colours, and you can't,
as a novelist, you can't go back and listen to recordings of what it sounded like, and yet you've got to recreate it on the page words in a way that speaks to the reader. So that's quite a challenge.
And I really enjoyed doing that. And afterwards, my editor said she hadn't known about synesthesia at all. Somebody else had. She talked to somebody else. And they said, no, they had. She said, it was quite extraordinary. About sort of a month after they went the editing process, they got another book submitted about it. And she said, nobody turned. And they're saying, how extraordinary. Somebody else, they turned it down because they already had mine. She said, it was a good novel. And I have no idea where it is now. But she said, clearly it's something that's sort of coming to people's interest. But Crossing of Senses is just in itself interesting. And I think one of the biggest differences 100 years ago was sound and probably smell, body smells, and that's where we would have felt ourselves to be in a very different place, I think. So that's probably the biggest, that was the biggest challenge.
You're now working on the third Lawrence Bartram novel.
Yes.
But tell me a little bit about any plans you might have, or any ideas you might have beyond that. Are there any projects you're already beginning to mull over, or is it too early to say?
It's a bit early. I mean, the next Lawrence Bartram is very much, it's set in Italy, the sort of rise of Mussolini, when the British are paying extremely large sums of money to Mussolini to keep him in and to let him assemble his fascist party, and keep Italy, which feels it suffered particularly badly on the side of the Allies in the First World War, to stabilise the country, and obviously making a serious error of judgment, we now know. And I was interested, this is sort of 1924-25, because that's the first time that intelligent people began to realise they hadn't fought the war to end all wars. They hadn't lost 1 million men, ultimately for a very good cause, to settle Europe. And I just think that must have been an absolutely terrible and extraordinary period when you have to accept that. So I'm moving forward there. I think my novel after that would be set, wouldn't be Lawrence Bartram, but it would go forward, because actually he will get too old, but it will go forward in history to the sort of early 1930s. And I'm quite interested in looking at a real life. A lot of my novels combine real life with fiction, a real life, very strange disappearance of a politician, corruption and things that people will recognise that go on in politics all the time. So I would probably move into that period. But I would quite like to write a modern novel, but I just don't think it could be a conventional narrative because of all the problems that about how you structure that. But I do, I wouldn't mind. I did a bit of ghost writing for a very high-powered businessman, and he wanted to have a blog, he had no idea about, and I was to write his blog, and I was to tell him what books he should have been said to reading or what plays he might have seen. And this was quite fun, and I thought that might make quite a novel, where somebody's inventing the man to make him an accessible man, and he at the same time rather like, sort of grows to rather like the man that's invented. And I mean, this would be quite, probably quite a lightweight story, but it would be relevant to issues that we're now dealing with the internet. So that would quite interest me.
And do you think you've left nonfiction behind forever?
No, there are some things I would like to write about, but only in the ways I want to write about them. I mean, I love the way when people take an artifact or a very, very small incident, or sometimes a building. I can't remember who wrote the one about a single church where you sort of just unfold the layers. I like that tiny microhistory that expands to be something much, much larger. I can't see myself writing a sort of, I'm 5 years later with the Treaty of Lausanne. I would leave that to the academics who do it better. There's a book to be written, I think, about if I did write nonfiction, about the French experience in the Great War, because there's almost nothing in English. In the best book still probably is Horn's book on France before the war and then up to Verdun, and there's nothing comparable really, and there's over 1,000 books on the Somme, so it'd be interesting to do that, but it's probably something for a military historian, I think.
That was Elizabeth Speller in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Elizabeth on her website at www.elizabethspeller.com. And that concludes episode 57, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 58, the poet Ian Duhigg speaks with Julia Copus about his early life and work and the genesis of his well-known and much-loved poem, The Lammas Hireling. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.